Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear Kevin Barry read his story, Deer Season, from the October 10th, 2016 issue of the magazine. Kevin Barry is the author of two story collections and two novels, including last year's Beetlebone. He's been publishing fiction in The New Yorker since 2010. Now here's Kevin Barry.
Deer Season. She saw him often in the morning, and often again around dusk as he walked out by the river. She called him the River Man. She had seen him only in the distance and had not properly distinguished his features. She was almost 18 and determined to have a fuck before it. But she lived remotely, and the summer was almost over. He was tall and thin and did not have a pronouncedly masculine walk. He could not be taken for a farmer. His step was carefully picked out, and it had a hesitancy to it. It brought to her mind the heron. She needed to get closer to him quickly. The morning was bright, with a breeze that moved the light's sharp points on the lanes, and the hedges were opulent with berries, and the high grasses raced in the late summer fields. She set out for the banks of the river along the lit points of the lanes. She had taken a book for cover after a long think about which book exactly to take. She pulled her cardigan tight against the morning chill that marked the seasons changing. Even before the river's sour waft was in her nose, she had decided on the tree that she would sit beneath. She arranged the picture in her mind. She felt that she could see what was coming and that she could make events turn to her design. She felt a quick thrum of new sexual power. She fretted that the cardigan, a grey, might seem a little nunly. But if nunly, she reasoned, perhaps an intriguing counterpoint to the somewhat lurid cover of the Bolaño novel, which showed a Mexican death's head. Often her thoughts went in these contrary directions at once. He might not be a reader at all. He might be curt and indifferent to her, but this was not what she made out from the hesitant, loping step. She would bet the farm on manners. The country was beautiful now that August was almost over. The heavier growth was done with, and the tall grasses that moved in the breeze had faded to a whitish gold, and the reed banks wore a still paler gold, and the yellow flags of June had withered on the long stems but moved in their flayed tatters yet. She endured rather than enjoyed all this. She had declared herself a romantic, and bare winter was her idyll. There was a chill from the river, and fingers of mist crept from it, and a dampness rose into her from the shaded ground she sat on beneath the tree. She opened the book and set it on her thighs and tried to read about strangulated prostitutes in the desert, but the words swam madly. She was very nervous. He showed, soon enough, around the bend of the river, and she drew him toward her along the line. She saw now, as he came closer, that he was, in fact, much older than her, maybe in his 30s, and she knew that he registered her. "I'm ready," she said, under her breath. He stopped in his tracks and waved. He came still closer. She saw at near range that he was good-looking enough, with a long and sharp-featured face that was pinched with kindness, and scruffy hair with some grey in its wires. And his eyelashes closed slowly now and opened again, a long exposure to inspect her. "Hello," he said.
"Hi."
Their words were incongruous on the air. The moment of the riverbank here was seldom touched by human voices. But now it held clearly the riverman's and the girl's, and they both smiled at the fact of their intrusion on this place. There was only, as it got up again, the breeze among the grasses to distract them from each other. And they both looked out and across the moving grasses, as though casually, as though on the off chance of news. He turned back to her again with the knit bones of his smile. The smile was like something he had trapped, she thought. "I think I've seen you before," he said. This was a revelation, and it needed to be answered inside the beat of a second. If he had seen her loitering in the fields, he might have seen the way that she watched him too and read her intention, and the spite. All that she had drilled into herself about not appearing eager, she fixed her hair now with her fingertips, and even before the strand of hair was settled behind her ear, she cursed silently the obviousness of the gesture. He got down on his haunches, laid a hand to his long, skinny knee, and smiled at her. She set the book to one side.
"I live over that way," she said.
"Ah, yeah," he said, and he twisted his face to read the name on the book's cover.
"Roberto
Bolaño," she said.
"Any good?"
"He's dead."
"Oh, that's gloomy."
"No, it isn't. I mean, the book isn't." She had worried that the book might be a terrible idea, but here it was, doing its work, opening a pathway to conversation. She didn't have any great desire for the man, but she liked his voice, and he wasn't fat. He definitely didn't sound as if he came from around here. He was English, but country English. He wanted the talk to continue. She could see that well enough. "I had to burn half my books last year," he said. "I had a very bad chest cold, and I couldn't get out, and all my fuel was gone." Now she recognized the hesitancy of his walk for what it was, for poverty. He had the hunted look of rural poverty. His clothes were not good, army surplus, with ugly stout boots, but his limbs were long and lean, and she was inclined to keep the conversation going. In just a week, she would be 18.
"So cold you had to burn books?"
"Remember the cold snap, January? It was evil around here."
"I'd have been away," she said. "School."
"School still?"
"For another year," she said,
and let a slyness assert.
"Where do you go
in the mornings?" "I go up the forestry," he said, "though I shouldn't tell."
"Why not?"
"I've been taking some wood down. I'm leaving it to dry out. September, I'll start lugging it back to my place. You know they say it warms you 3 times wood, when you cut it down, when you carry it, when you burn it. You're thinking ahead."
"That's right.
And you're stealing from the forestry. They've plenty."
"What if you were caught?"
"You'd need to be pretty stupid to be caught. It's vast, the forestry. It goes right from here, right from here and over the Ox Mountains. What's your name?
I'm Edward.
I think you're a strange fish, Eddie.
A cold fish was what I was last winter.
And I'm definitely not an Eddie.
What's your name?
The next day, they met not quite by arrangement, but by understanding. This time, he sat beside her under the tree. She was very tense, though she pretended not to be as she sat with her legs kicked out in front of her. She was without the pretense of a book this time. Their bodies were tight and agitated in this proximity, but each face was half turned for its glance to lock on the others. Sentimental grasses wavered in a lighter breeze. Autumn was moving in with stealth. Early in the morning, there had been stags' roars beyond the trees. He asked about her life, and she sighed impatiently and ticked off the father and the farm, the dead mother, the older brother, William, who was away to be a doctor, the significant fact of her return soon to boarding school, and she was aware that every word signified the extent of the gap between them in this country at this time, and the gap would, of course, feed into his fantasies about her, which, she was sure, were already hot, fetid, and possessing. And now the 4 days until the train went back through the Midlands to her school seemed like all the time in the world to make this happen. She decided that she found him attractive enough for the job at hand. She touched him for the first time, just the pads of her fingertips to his skinny biceps. Like a dog's muscle, it twitched madly. And he rose, half terrified, his neck a rush of crimson, and made off down the river. She would need to be gentle with him.
"Enjoy the timbering," she called,
and she may have accentuated the switching of her hips as she moved off and away from the river herself, across the pale gold fields. He would crane for as long as he could to follow her walk. She was sure of that. Until she had disappeared from view. And he would be away to masturbate immediately in the woods then. She was sure of that, too. It was as easy as making a ladybird walk up the stem of a leaf. That night brought a warm, heavy rain that told the last heat of the year was on the way, and Thursday came up to the promised heat. She wore a skirt and applied some colour to her lips. Her father watched her as if it were a painted fox that crossed his yard. The morning was swampish, and there was a rotten vegetable stink from the ditches, and the berries were dull jewels on the hedges. She wanted it to happen quickly and then to be done with the whole unfathomable business. Her lips moved. She made words on the air as she walked, saying lowly and determinedly, "I will make of this riverbank a fuckery." And a bead of desperation formed in the indent above the centre of her lips. She was in a condition, all the same, of vaulting readiness. The bones of her feet beat down the path to the river, and there, already, the riverman was waiting. He had a face on him, like a washed dog. He was quieter, shyer, and even more awkward this hot morning, knowing as well himself that the moment had arrived, even before she turned to him. Midway through a ridiculous, halting conversation about dragonflies peculiar to the vicinity, and kissed him so hard and viciously she might have drawn blood. They rose then from beneath the tree and went away into the reeds like animals of the place. She lay down on the ground, and he lay down on top of her and kissed her, and moved against her for a short while, and then went further. And there was hardly any of the supposed pain. And really, to the girl, it just seemed badly designed. Fiddly. A contrivance. A make-do job, as her father might say. And he rolled off her just in time and rose onto his knees and came on the ground. A little boy's remorse filled up his eyes.
Is that about the size of it? She said.
Yeah, he said. There was nowhere left for them to go but into their own breathing flesh again, now that they were so quickly separated. He didn't show up by the river the following day or the next, and so, on the evening before her departure, she set out to find his house. She knocked on his door and let the raps play out a jaunty, half-comical rhythm. "Oh, sweet Jesus, fuck," he said when he opened the door, and sharply he hustled her inside. The house was a small bungalow. It was clean and tidy and reeked of animal want. He kept his back turned to her as he filled the kettle and set it to boil. Misery was essayed everywhere, in the lentils soaking on the draining board, in the way that he tried to scour a tea mug with his index finger under the running tap. She saw his glum and mortified face in the dulling window. The evening was already fading outside, late August leaning into September. "It's the sort of thing that could get me in a lot of trouble around here," he said. "Who'll know?" she said. He sucked his teeth and rolled a cigarette with the long, slightly crooked fingers that were the most elegant thing about him, and lit the cigarette and puffed out the smoke nervously. "You are 17, he said. "Not for long," she said. "I don't need a friend," he said. "And I no more want tea than the fucking wall," she said. When they had finished, this second and final time, and while he dozed or pretended to in the bedroom, she went through the narrow hallway and into the kitchen again. She examined his lair. There was a library book about foraging. There was the disheartening musk of adult maleness. There was a book about the bogs. There was The Sorrows of Young Werther. She had known well enough what she was doing. There was something military about the neatness. She stood in the doorway and envisioned his many possible lives and looked out to the blue night falling. Across the fields, she could hear the river moving. The river talked to itself of all that it had seen. She stood there for some time until the blue had thickened to near blackness, and she entered a spell of heavy dreaming or quietude such as can open out sometimes in youth if the person is to be an artist. And now the stars came true, and when she heard his wordless shuffling behind her to break the spell, she walked away through the yard and did not once look back. Half a term passed in the ritual frenzies of gossip and competition. She embellished gladly as she confided her late summer adventure. She told her friends that he had looked a bit like a skinnier Rufus Wainwright and was nearly as camp. Her father made his usual Sunday night phone calls and was full of his usual quiet news, mostly about Deer and his son.
"Oh, Willie was home the weekend. We went out. Willie got a buck. I got nothing."
But then, the third week of October, her father did not make his call. It was the first time ever that he had missed a call, and she knew at once why. He had got word of her adventure. She knew on the train home for midterm break that the great scene awaited, but still, to hear her father use the words he did was astonishing.
"What would your dead mother say if she knew I'd raised up a slut?
Where the fuck am I supposed to go with a question like that?
And the tongue on it!"
The quasi-biblical phrasing that had lurched in, raised up. In what demented reach of his person had he been storing this language? The late October day was peeled and cool, The light was miserly by six, the last remnants clawed in weak scratches across the sky. She stood with her back to the piano. The room was dense with gloom. The important news was that he was gone.
He was ran out of it,
her father said.
He was ran where?
He was ran.
Who ran him?
Her father reddened dangerously and made to cross the floor, but caught himself and turned his back to her. He spoke to the wall.
Did you protect yourself?
Ah, here, she said.
Did you not think it through?
I did not.
Did you protect yourself?
Nothing happened, Da.
You were seen. By fucking who? Aren't they hanging out of the fucking trees?
He turned and again made to cross the floor to her, but once more he caught himself.
Where did he go to, Da?
How would I know that?
Jesus Christ, girl.
I mean, any young fella at all your own age, and I'd nearly understand it. The half-wit Egypt of the Crimmonses even, but this old English whore. You know he's a stray in the head, you do. You know he's been in and out of the hospital. 10 months in that place below, and he paid rent twice.
How was he ran, Da? We were respectable people. At one time. Around here, you know that, don't you? Was he hurt, Daddy?
The lurch of fright in her voice was a sickening thing, and she fled the room in disgust at it. The fright betrayed a weight of feeling that was a surprise to her. She had carried it without knowing. Though she knew well enough, it was the idea of him rather than the fact. The idea of a long, thin, somber man in a soak of noble depression, smelling of lentils in a damp pebble-dash bungalow amid a scrabble of the white-thorn trees, a man ragged in the province of Connacht and alone at all seasons, perhaps already betrothed to a glamorous early debt and under some especially mischievous a raiment of the stars, he was all that a girl could ask for. There would have been no gothic scene. There would have been no baying mob. There would have been a rapping on the door one evening of the autumn, and quiet words spoken, and their intent understood at once. He would have packed his few things in a holdall and the next morning taken the bus from Ballymote. He would cross the country and the sea again. He would settle in a city of the north and try to find work and fail, and try to find a hostel and fail, and seek again the needle's tip and solace. On the needle's tip, he would nod and dream of the forestry land rising up to the Ox Mountains, and the slight girl with dyed black hair on the riverbank there one morning. She crossed the fields again as the October dark fell. She walked now beneath a cloak of widowly despair. She had arranged a picture for this scene too. She came on his bungalow in full darkness. It had not been let again, and the door was unlocked. All had been packed away and swept neatly. His bedroom was bare, the kitchen so bare. She sat on the kitchen floor long into the night. Outside, late on, something thrashed through the whitethorn and the sally trees. She knew it was a deer, and a young one by the measure of fright in its movement. But the night folded again into the quiet of its soft enclosure. It was moonless, and the great dark pressed in. She reached out for him in the dark. When she at last rose to go, she was stiff from the cold and felt many years older as she left the house and made for home through the night and dark, and the pads of her feet beat out the new soft rhythm of her power.
That was Kevin Barry reading his story Deer Season. His first novel, City of Bohane, won the International Impact Dublin Literary Award in 2013. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on newyorker.com and on the New Yorker apps, available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Karen Russell reads From the 15th District by Mavis Gallant. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Writer's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff and Alex Barron of newyorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.